How did musicals go from this?
Moaning a dark and dismal fate, forgo your cruel employ.
To this.
The internet is for poor.
My answer is it took a lot of genius and a lot of work. My name is Peter McGuire, and this is my unlikely explanation. This podcast is the first in a series I'm going to do on the development of the modern musical. There seems to be a very specific and schmaltzy tone that most musicals today at least nod to. And the first step on the road to that sound is Gilbert and Sullivan. Rather than try and give a comprehensive history, I'm going to give you my literary and musical analysis of these plays and introduce you to as much music as I can. So think of this as a guided tour of Gilbert and Sullivan. And the person I'm going to be guiding today is my friend Jess.
Hey.
Hi. We took later Victorians together in our English program that we did a decade ago.
Oh my God. Yeah.
I also think about how I didn't read any of Our Mutual Friend, which we had a class every week to discuss.
I don't know if I read any of it either. Do you remember?
I didn't read any of it.
I would have told you if I'd read it or not.
I remember. I think you stuck with it, I think, a little longer than I did, because we were supposed to make forum posts every week.
Zero recollection.
So I would read like two pages of it, like throw some together.
Isn't this the dark, like, underbelly of being an English major in school, though? Is that, like, did any of us complete the reading ever?
I'm gonna give Jess the guided tour of Gilbert and Sullivan.
Can't wait.
And see how this podcast works if there's two people. Musicals are an important part of understanding the pop music that we listen to today. Even though nowadays we consider music from musicals to be sort of novelty music that's not usually heard outside of the shows, aside from an occasional breakout hit, and I'm not going to play Let It Go here, I'm going to spare you that. But theatrical music and pop music have shared a long entwined history, and many of the melodies and forms have been traded between the two. Keep in mind, when we listen to most of what's considered classical music, a lot of it was written to accompany a visual performance, like a ballet or an opera. Gilbert and Sullivan wrote their plays in the 1870s and 80s, based on forms of opera that had been popular on the continent for centuries, but more directly on the light comic operas that were starting to take Europe by storm. And I'm talking about this kind of music.
Very familiar.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
For context, this is the same time when Wagner was writing Der Ring. That's right, of the Valkyries. That's where you'll know that from. And Johann Strauss was writing operettas in Vienna, and they had this kind of sound.
This was an intense time. No one was taking it lighthearted. No one was dialing it back at all.
Yeah, yeah. This was serious.
Everyone was at level 10.
The time was right for a new kind of entertainment in England. Transportation was improving, with better and faster trains throughout the aisles, and so too was nighttime illumination. It was suddenly easier and safer for families to go out for a night of entertainment. In England, theater had dwindled to short runs of bawdy, pun-filled plays, and occasional performances from the only respectable English dramatist, who was Shakespeare, who was also very bawdy and full of puns in all of his plays. The time was right for a new perspective in English theater, and this is what we got.
I am heaven on the quill and the fury of a gale, and I'm never, never sick at sea.
What, never?
No, never.
What, never?
Hardly ever.
He's hardly ever sick at sea.
This is the work of W.S. Gilbert, a writer known for his comic, often satirical verse, as well as the libretti for several short comic plays and extravaganzas, as he called them, and Arthur Sullivan, who was an up-and-coming composer of ballets, concertos, hymns, parlor songs, and a few comic operas of his own. Gilbert was mostly interested in satire and subversion. He created fanciful scenarios, and he'd recontextualize the absurdity of his own society. His plots were often described as topsy-turvy. Sullivan, on the other hand, considered himself to be a serious composer who was destined for greatness and took on lighter work only to keep himself from going bankrupt in the meantime. The discrepancy between their self-images would cause strife throughout their collaboration, but in the meantime, they would become one of England's most cherished institutions.
And, like, what was the deal between the two? How did they meet?
They were brought together by Mr. Richard Doyley Cart. Who was a promoter who saw an opportunity to make bank and noticed that these two guys were working in similar areas. So he actually brought them together.
Oh my God. And their first place, original boy band, yeah. Technically.
Yeah. Super group, yeah. And then once their plays started getting popular, they were just making too much money to stop making them, basically. It just became this engine where they always needed a new play to put on at the theater. So they were always, and they were just making
bank
off of
everyone.
So they
couldn't stop the inertia of their.
Yeah, once they first started working together, they were just making money hand over fist.
They had like a tense relationship. They weren't friends, is what you're saying.
It would come and go. So yeah, their promoter, Doyley Cart, built a theater specifically to stage their work, which had only happened for Wagner yet at this point. And it has been staging their plays for the last 107 years. Despite their tremendous profitability and their huge success and Richard Doyley Cart's best efforts to keep it going, Gilbert and Sullivan's partnership fell apart amid bickering. And although they patched things up later in life and actually wrote a few more plays, they never regained the popularity and esteem that their earlier work had. They're considered quite lesser plays, the later ones. So let's take a listen to the kind of music they made.
My name is John Wellington Wells. I'm a dealer in magic and spells. In blessings and curses and ever fill purses in prophecies, witches and bells. If you want a proud foe to make tracks, if you'd melt a rich uncle in wax, you've but to look in on the resident gin number 70, Simmeriax. We've a first-class assortment of magic, and for raising a posthumous shade, with effects that are comic or tragic, there's no cheaper house in the trade. Love filter with quantities of it, and for knowledge if anyone burns, we're keeping a very small profit, a profit who brings us unbounded returns. For he can prophesy with a wink of his eye, peep the security into futurity, sum up your history, clear up a mystery, humor proclivity, for the nativity, for the nativity.
So that's from one of the earlier plays. I think that's kind of the prototypical Gilbert and Sullivan sound.
So much jauntier than what we heard before. So yeah. Much more fun.
Yes. Hearing this for me was like finding a missing link in evolution, because I could immediately hear how it connects earlier opera like this. To some of the songs that I like to listen to when I was growing up.
Oh, man.
Did that spark a memory for you?
Oh, my God. Some very uncomfortable middle school memories just came flooding back.
These are called patter songs, and they seem to operate on the principle that assonance and consonants are twice as fun when you perform them twice as fast. It's likely no coincidence that a rap musical worked and worked really well when there are so many patter songs throughout our musical and pop history.
Yeah.
They're often used in Gilbert and Sullivan to introduce a character, such as this actually famous example.
I am the very model of a modern major general, life information, vegetable, animal, and mineral.
Or in this example from Ruddigore, which I think is just amazing.
If I had been so lucky as to have a steady brother who could talk to me as we are talking now to one another, who could give me good advice when he discovered I was erring, which is just the very favor which I knew I am converting.
Did that voice sound familiar to you at all? Vincent Price. That was Vincent Price.
Oh my God.
He did like some musicals in his time.
That's crazy.
I love that. I couldn't believe it when I was seeing Vincent Price singing Gilbert and Sullivan.
Did your brain explode? It looks like it did.
It was kind of a reboot moment. So I want to kind of tease out a little bit of what was Sullivan and what was Gilbert and what did each of them bring to the thing.
Yeah.
So let's go back to the beginning of what I can find for Sullivan. His earliest remaining play is Cox and Box. So we're going to talk about Cox and Box.
His first play was called Cox and Box. Okay. Okay.
So this is him working with a different librettist, but bringing his, I think you can hear a very Sullivan-y sound even in this early recording. So this is from Cox and Box.
My aged employer with his physiognomy shining from serve like a star in astronomy said, Mr. Cox, you'll oblige me and honor me if you would take this as your holiday. If you would take this as your holiday.
Isn't that nice?
Now for my breakfast, my lunch, and a nay.
so fancy.
He was a very fancy composer. But yeah, again, remember, this is like 1880s, and you heard some of that context, like, this was a time of a very ornamented music. The music in these plays sounds so different from modern musicals, and from pop songs, for that matter. You can find some similarities in writers like Sondheim, but it feels much more rooted in symphonic music than the type of stuff we listen to today.
Yeah.
Some of these melodies are really sweet in a uniquely romantic era way, and they have a subtlety and a complexity that you don't hear that much in musicals these days. So I want to play you an example from one of their earlier collaborations, Trial by Jury, where Gilbert is making a satire of the legal profession.
Ooh, scandalous.
Yes. So, and he was a lawyer before he started writing verse, actually. So
Sullivan.
Gilbert.
Gilbert.
The writer. Well, so like in college, he wrote some like little poems and stuff, and then he went into law.
And then dad was like, you need to make some real money.
Yeah, and then his poems started taking off, and so that kind of allowed him to get into writing for different things. This is one of their like dilemma songs. A lot of their shows have a moment where everybody sits down and goes, what do we do? So this is the entire jury sings along with the prosecutor about what a dilemma they have here.
A nice dilemma we have here. That calls for all our wit, for all our wit.
I like to think about how that came together, because Gilbert just wrote a nice dilemma we have here that calls for all our wit. And that's what Sullivan did with it.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Gilbert and Sullivan brought over from the opera and from earlier theater traditions the idea of the chorus, as in a group of singers that comment on the action of the play. In most cases, the chorus simply repeats the principal melody so that the musical line has balance. So this is from HMS Pinafore.
That pass examination did so well for me that now I am the ruler of the Queen's Navy.
That pass examination did so well for me that now he's the ruler of the Queen's Navy.
And with this repeating style, you get a lot of this.
Yes, yes,
yes, yes, yes, yes, yes, yes,
yes, yes, yes,
yes, yes,
yes,
yes,
yes,
yes, yes,
yes, yes,
yes.
And that's just Pirates of Penzance. Yes, yes, that's how you do a chorus reply. But sometimes the chorus plays a more active role in the song. Like in this example from Pirates of Penzance, where the police are told that they must bravely face their death.
That is not a pleasant way of putting it.
And I thoroughly enjoy how Gilbert plays with the chorus, sometimes poking fun at the opera form itself. So here's a great example from that same play where we have all the pirates sing this triumphant song about how utterly quiet they are. That last bit there was them saying a fly's footfall would be distinctly heard as they march on stage.
But wait, like we've gone from like really serious musicals to Gilbert and Sullivan. Like how were they were very popular, but did people originally think that they were ridiculous, that they were like poking fun at the very medium that they were playing in?
So I don't know so much on the subversion point. I think people honestly just looked at them as these like stupid, you know, nights out of, you know, silly wordplay and fun.
Just like a body good time, and that was it.
Yeah, and okay. I think what Gilbert was doing was kind of like another step beyond what the expectations were of the audience. I mean, we talked a lot in that later Victorian class as well about how, as the Victorian era was coming to an end, all these forms had become stuffy and people were starting to realize that.
Yeah.
And elaborating and doing weird stuff with them. So I think he does prefigure the modern sort of composers that are going to come right after him a little bit. I think he's, like, starting to tiptoe into that.
Because I could see the serious musical people being like, this is ridiculous.
Yes.
You're, what have you done? You've made a mess of this whole thing.
Well, and also keep in mind, like, all the serious operas that were going on, those are all in German or Italian. There was not really any English language theater like this prior to. So they come out, triumphantly sing, we're so quiet, bum, bum, ba, bum, quiet. And then, right afterwards, their intended victim comes out and sings this.
And as I lay in bed awake, I thought I heard a noise.
So, I think that's indicative of what Gilbert brought to this collaboration.
Yeah.
The music is often played earnestly, complementing the lyrics, but it usually stays fairly within the conventions of the time. Gilbert, meanwhile, seems so self-aware as to sound practically modern at times. In Trial by Jury, there's a great moment that I think could work in a satire of a musical today.
Let me speak. Let me speak. Let me speak. Let me speak. Let me speak.
He'll tell us how he can go.
And you can hear it end on the bailiff's order in court.
No, it does sound really, really modern, and it's still funny.
Yeah.
Like, it still works.
Yeah.
Which is really surprising, I think. So, do you have a favorite between the two? Are you, like, more into the wordsmithing or the music? Are you a Gilbert or a Sullivan?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, I do. I compose my own music, for sure.
Yeah.
But
isn't it the wordplay that sort of made it timeless?
Yeah, I do. I honestly do. A lot of this for me is the textual parts of it.
Yeah, definitely. They're both dead, so, like, they're not going to be offended.
God, you're making me... It's a Sophie's Choice. I think the wordplay definitely is what keeps it fresher. Although there's a certain beauty to the music that I would like to have more of in the modern era that we live in.
Okay, but you're Team Gilbert, if you had to choose.
If they were fighting in the room with me,
yeah,
I was like caught in that situation, would probably side Gilbert if I had to.
In this imagining, I feel like you're their kid and they're getting a divorce, and you side with Gilbert.
Yeah, after they've adopted me. Oh, what a dream. But beyond that, Gilbert was just a great poet. Many of his turns of phrase have become a normal part of our lexicon. You postponed a few times on me, and I said I was going to call you by your middle name, a dreaded name, and your response was...
Punishment fits the crime.
So that's something that Gilbert gave us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yep. So he would turn thoughts like, oh no, I hope I don't get executed, into poems like this.
To sit in solemn silence in a dull dark cup, in a pestilential prison with a life on lock, awaiting the sensation of a short sharp shot, from a cheapy cheapy chopper on a big black block. A dull dark cup, a life on lock, a short sharp shot, a big black block. To sit in solemn silence in a pestilential prison, and awaiting the sensation of a cheapy cheapy chopper on a big black block.
What must it have been like to be in his brain? Like, that is really challenging. That is some...
I mean...
That guy's a little... He's a difficult
after
guy.
After doing all this research and putting this together, I felt like I was going insane from the way that he writes. So I can't imagine being the font of that.
Exactly.
It's a lot of words.
A lot of intensity.
Yeah, for sure. So now that we've talked about the context and we've talked about the skills of each man a little bit, let's look at some more moments where their work really shines as a collaboration, where they both brought a lot to it. In Pirates, there's a moment when our tenor protagonist, who has been a child pirate his whole life, and therefore he's never seen women, because musicals have never made sense. He
there
sees
aren't women.
Women
allowed on ships. They're bad luck.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And so they've never docked anywhere
right.
his whole life. Mm-hmm. He's only, and then also
besides the occasional seductive mermaid, obviously.
Yeah, well, and then they do actually have a woman in their crew, but she's old and unattractive, so.
So she doesn't count? Wow.
So he finally sees women for the first time, and she goes, oh no, now he's going to realize that I'm not the most beautiful woman in the world. So he does finally see women, and he tries to woo them.
Wait, how old is he?
He just turned 21.
Yikes. Okay.
So, again, I think this sounds... focus on both the music and the lyrics. I think the lyrics are weirdly modern. So he sees women for the first time, and he decides to woo them thusly.
Is there not one maiden here whose homely face and bad complexion have caused all hope to disappear? Such a one, if such there be, I swear by heaven's arch above you, if you will cast your eyes on me, however plain you'll be, I'll love you.
Wait, so he was just saying, it doesn't matter what you look like, as ugly as you might be, I'm here with love to give you, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Gilbert and Sullivan equivalent of last call at the bar, you up text.
Yeah.
Right. And they responded with what? I like, can't even hear what
their response was simply, no, there's not one maiden here whose homely face and bad complexion have caused all hope to disappear of ever winning man's affection.
So fuck off.
So like if you're writing
good
a play today
for them.
Yeah, right. So if you're writing a play today and you have your neckbeard character emerge from his basement for the first time to talk to women, what a great way, right? It still works today. He comes out and goes, well, if there's anyone ugly enough here for me, I'll take them.
Dude. Oh my god.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my god, neck beard.
Right? It's essentially, I mean, he's never seen women before. I also want to point out a moment from their most popular show, The Mikado, that stands out to me. There's a song where we're introduced to the Mikado himself. He's the Emperor of Japan, and he explains that it's his most humane duty to reform justice in Japan by making the punishment fit the crime. This was really a way for Gilbert to poke fun at Victorian society sinners that he disliked in London. Here's the terrible fate assigned for the pool shark.
And there he plays extravagant matches in featureless finger sprawls on a cloth on a true with a twisted keel and elliptical billiard ball.
What was he saying?
He has to play with a twisted cue on a cloth untrue with elliptical billiard balls.
Harsh.
What a terrifying thought. Right? And then also from that play, we get this, which I think is wickedly subversive. We have our young minstrel, our protagonist, is trying to convince Coco, an older man, to marry the woman that the protagonist doesn't want to marry. So he's in an arranged...
Why is he trying to convince him of that?
He's in an arranged marriage. He loves another woman. So he comes up with a plan. If Coco marries the woman that he's betrothed to, then she can have no claim over him because she'll already be married. So then he'll go off with his loved one, which okay. is actually ultimately what happens in the show.
Okay. And Coco is an older man.
Yeah, who is actually the warden of the love interest. And he
Yikes.
Really creepily earlier in the play says that he's been training her to love him her
the
entire
ward.
Life.
Who's and, not his betrothed.
And now she's being stolen out from under him.
This is
so
fucked
to
up.
Add insult to injury, he's been grooming a girl his whole life. Young protagonist comes in, whisks her away, and tries to convince him to marry his nasty betrothed who he doesn't want to marry.
And Coco takes the bait.
So this is...
And gives his groomed warden to our protagonist. Yeah. Great. Ladies, join me in outrage.
Yep. So this is our protagonist trying to convince Coco to marry this
woman. Why
is his
name Coco? I can't get over this.
It's Japan. Everything's in Japan. So one girl's name is Pity Sing. And then there's Coco. There's Princess Yum Yum.
Stop. Stop.
The flowers that bloom in the spring, tra-la, green promise of merry sunshine. As we merrily dance and we sing, tra-la, we welcome the hope that they bring, tra-la, of a summer of roses and wine, of a summer of roses and wine. And that's what we mean when we say that a thing is welcome as flowers that bloom in the spring.
So, cues it up in a super positive way.
Yeah.
And then Coco responds.
The flowers that bloom in the spring, ta-la, have nothing to do with the case. I've got to take under my wing, ta-la, a most unattractive old thing, ta-la, with a caricature of a face, with a caricature of a face. And that's what I mean when I say or I sing. Oh, bother the flowers that bloom in the spring. Tra-la-la-la-la, tra-la-la-la-la. Oh, bother the flowers of spring.
Have you ever heard a sassier tra-la-la-la-la in your life?
Right, exactly.
That is shade right there.
Yeah. That actor I love, too. He did... typically, the Doily Car Theater would have, like, an official person for each... There's, like, certain archetypes that show up in pretty much every play. So, pretty much, they would just hire one person who would play that archetype in whatever play. That guy played the, like, comic lead in for, like, 30 or 40 years.
Oh, my God.
By the time they recorded these, he was nailing... I think these were recorded in, like, the 50s, and he was just nailing it.
He knew what was up. Yeah. He knew how to do this. Wait, so the theater that was built for them was named after the proprietor that built it?
Yeah, the Doily Car Theater.
Stop. Haven't you been back since, though? Have you been to the theater before?
Well, no, I'm cutting this part out, too.
Questioning the legitimacy of this podcast is apparently not allowed on this podcast.
I'm the editor of this podcast, so...
I think it should stay in.
Okay, and then at the end of the Mikado, we have a song where Coco then seduces this most unattractable thing with a caricature of a face.
How does he know the protagonist's betrothed, though? How does he know her?
She's the daughter-in-law-elect. We first get introduced to the emperor and the daughter-in-law-elect at the same time. And that's also a great song. The emperor comes out very pompously and say something. And he's like, no one is as just as the emperor of Japan. And then she goes, except his daughter-in-law-elect. So she's introduced as this like one-upper from the beginning.
Okay, so the emperor and then the protagonist is the emperor's son, the prince or whatever.
Yes.
And he is betrothed to...
Yes.
Okay. But he doesn't want her.
Yeah.
And it's like a political match?
Yeah, I think that's... yeah.
Okay.
It's not really explicitly said.
Right. And he wants Coco's girl instead.
Yes.
His ward.
I'm glad you put it together.
Well, I'm sorry, but it's kind of important. These are some awkward dynamics.
It's part of why I glossed over it as well. There's a lot of... We'll talk about troubling things later.
Yeah, no, I definitely... Well, let's get to that.
So this is Coco trying to seduce this most unattractable thing by turning his anxieties about her into positives.
Okay.
Beauty in extreme old age. Do you fancy you are elderly enough? Information I'm requesting on a subject interesting is a maiden all the better when she's tough.
Throughout this wide dominion, it's the general opinion that she'll last a good deal longer when she's tough.
Are you old enough to marry, do you think? Won't wait till you're 80 in the shade. There's a fascination frantic in a ruin that's romantic. Do you think you are sufficiently decayed?
To the matter that you mention, I have given some attention, and I think I am sufficiently decayed.
If that is so, sing derry down derry, it's evident very our tastes are one. Away we'll go and verily marry nor tardily, tarry till day is done. If that is so, sing derry down derry, it's evident very our tastes are one. Away we'll go and verily marry nor tardily, tarry till day is done. Sing derry down derry, we'll marry nor tardily, tarry till day is done.
see, so it all ends happily. Because she is sufficiently decayed.
Because she's super old, and she's owning it.
Yep.
She's been well-aged, guys. Mm-hmm. She's been...
She's matured. Like a cheese. Let's talk about some of the things that haven't aged as well.
Yeah.
Let's start with some more innocuous things, though.
Okay.
So first, there's just some silliness around how language changes. I already mentioned Cox and Box was Sullivan's first play.
Yeah.
Titter, titter, titter. And then there's this line in HMS Pinafore that sounds a little surprising to me.
The bothers I may occasionally see, I never use a big, big D.
What's never?
No, never.
What's never?
Hardly ever.
Hardly ever swears the big, big D.
Wow.
It's got to be talking about the word damn, but whew, as a millennial listening to that.
Yeah. Surely there was a double entendre being made there, right?
He never uses the big, big D.
Yeah, was dick a term in the Victorian era is really the question.
I think that's actually where it like became a term, yeah.
Really? Because
it meant, like same as Peter, it just meant any Tom, Dick, or Harry.
Right.
That's where it came from.
Oh,
and I think this is the year. Now let's tackle some of the stuff let's get a little thornier with our problems.
Hell yeah. Bring on the thorns.
So as good historians, we need to keep in mind these were Victorian men writing in Victorian times.
Yes.
Everyone is a product of their culture.
There's a context here. I'm respectful of that.
They didn't invent this culture. they grew up in it.
Listeners, he's giving me quite a face as he's saying these things.
Just keep in mind the past is a foreign country.
You're right.
We must treat them like a different culture from our own, because it is.
Yeah, they're aliens.
Yes. Okay. In Pirates of Penzance, there's a moment where all of these maidens are hanging out undefended, waiting for the Major General to come, you know, chaperone them or whatever dad's wards do.
Right.
And the pirates come upon them, and they sing this.
Wait, so what are they saying there?
So there's some stuff in there that I like. So they say, like, we shall quickly be parsonified, conjugally matrimonified. So stuff like that's pretty funny.
Oh, my.
It's a bunch of undefended maidens on stage, and the pirates come in singing, here's a first-rate opportunity to get married with impunity.
And to be conjugally matrimonified.
Yeah.
Yikes. Okay.
And then they reprise that at the very end, and they add a verse where they say, hymenially joined.
Oh my god! No! Hymen puns! Stop!
Yeah. So that's...
Those poor maidens.
So that's a rape scene.
That's definitely a rape scene. Yikes.
I don't know. Like, what else? Like, here's a first-rate opportunity to get married with impunity. We did need to establish...
I love that they're couching it as marriage.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They're going to marry them all against their will. And actually, that comes... So then the Major General shows up shortly afterwards, and they go, oh, we've set to marry your daughters. And they go, against our will, Papa. Against our will.
But it's not just like a hit-and-run scene. They're marrying them. They're raping them and marrying them. Is that, like, was that the context in which it was Victorian acceptable to, like, have a rape scene?
Yeah, I think that's what makes it cute. I'm going to put that in big quotes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, again, different time, different context, but that's what made it worthy of a musical, was because at the end of this, they had
everyone's
both.
Getting married, everyone's going to move
right.
on to a
babies
happy...
babies are next, yay! Although,
yeah, so I will also say, at the very end of it, the happy reveal is that all the pirates are secretly lords that have run away from their duties, so they're all going to join Parliament, the House of Lords, and all of the maidens will become ladies.
Right, because if you're going to be raped and forced into marriage, as long as it's a lord, it's good. You were good.
It's very respectable.
It's this is a romance, guys. This is a romance.
this is truly a romance story.
This is a happy ending.
So that's gross.
That's super gross and offensive. Mm-hmm. But again, a different time. Also, why was that funny? Why was that? It's a bro joke. It's an old school bro joke. Okay, got it.
I guess. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. This is the earliest form of, like, what is the saying? Like, yes means yes, no means anal. That's what this is.
I'm cutting that out, too. That's not going in the podcast.
Bye.
Yikes. we don't use that kind of humor here, Jess.
I'm sorry, but Gilbert and Sullivan started it, okay?
That's fair. Yeah, so that's gross. Then we've got the Mikado. The Mikado is, as you have pointed out, there's a number of problems with the romantic plots.
Yeah.
There's also a really big problem today of the cultural elements of it, seeing as it's set in Japan. So there's a lot of stereotypes that we are all very sick of. The emperor is pretty much every trope of an oriental despot you can have. He thinks he's wise, but he's actually a buffoon. He has too much power, but also too many bureaucrats. And he's weirdly effeminate, but at the same time has no emotion for anybody at all. So it's all that, you know, really old, like, oh, this is what orientals are like, kind of Western perspective.
Yeah.
And then the daughter-in-law elect is this archetype of the reaching woman who has to be taken down a notch. She's offensively ugly and unpleasant, and the great comic ending is seeing her grab for power denied because Coco marries her, and it stymies all of her ambitions of becoming the emperor's daughter.
Yeah. But when you think about it, like, of course this is the humor that they had because this was their lives.
Yep.
Like, yeah, exactly. The context of their lives was marriage and power play. So, of course, this is the kind of jokes that they were going to make.
Yeah, exactly.
You're right.
Yep, you got it. So then the love interest in comparison is this submissive wilting flower. And as we talked about, she was the ward of Coco who wanted to marry
her. She'd been groomed.
Yeah, that's what we call it today.
Ew.
Mm-hmm. A lot of racist and sexist assumptions going on.
Yeah.
And then there's the problem with it being in Japan. This makes it really hard to stage today. The play never really attempts to portray Japan in a realistic way. It's definitely a satire of England. And there's lines like this.
Congratulate me, gentlemen, I found a volunteer.
The Japanese equivalent of here, here, here.
So they literally say the Japanese equivalent of here, 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 you know, things like that. That clearly they weren't trying to make this a realistic Japan in any way.
Was the point to poke fun at British politics at the time? They just wanted to set it in Japan to make it less, like, more palatable. Okay.
Exactly. You nailed it. So when you put it on today, you have to either choose between playing it the way it's written and looking racist.
Yeah.
Or you can set it in kind of a more imaginary way. And honestly, this could really take place in, like, a medieval Europe or, like, a fairyland. It's the same sort of, like, bizarre logic at play. We have one man took on all the county seats, so he has to, like, prosecute himself in court and this kind of thing. And then we have, like, the executioner who they made execute. So Coco is the, like, executioner. He was sentenced to death, so they made him the executioner so that no one could be executed, because the first person he would have to execute is himself.
Right.
But the bottom line in the 21st century is that the Mikado is set in this weird imperial English perspective of Japan. So when people stage it today, they have to either come off kind of bad, or they can start changing parts of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And that might not actually be a bad way to go. There's two songs in the Mikado with N-words in them, like hardcore.
Really?
Yeah.
But
I was listening.
Japan. What's happening?
I was listening back to some early recordings while I was researching this, and that, you know, once you've heard it the modern way, it's pretty startling to hear N-bombs being dropped on you.
Right.
Apparently, it was not a reference to actual black people. It was a reference to minstrel shows. Not sure that makes it a lot better. Coco is talking about his list of people that he will kill if he has to start executing people. He's made himself a little list in advance.
It's good to be prepared.
Yeah. And so the original lyrics were updated to the banjo serenader and others of his race. In the 50s, they made some updates like that, which 50s still feels pretty darn late to be doing updating your lyrics. But the official doily cart lyrics got changed. And so that kind of started a tradition with that song, the list song, of productions updating it, some or all of the lyrics, whenever it's put on. So you go from a line that Gilbert wrote, like this one.
All persons who in shaking hands shake hands with you like that.
Gotta hate a floppy handshake.
Mm.
And updated in a, like, 2000s Australian production to this.
There's the ticket holder next to you who cannot work their phone and cannot get the gist. I've got her on the list. Who leaves it on or switches to that dreadful silent drone. Facebook fiends and Twitterists are also on the list.
Oh my God, I love this so much.
So I think that's really fun.
That Gilbert would be offended by his lyrics being changed for the modern time.
So I don't know. Especially, I mean, this is true of a lot of his songs, but especially the Mikado seems to really be digging into like satire of the times that he lived in. So yeah. Something tells me that like it's kind of perfect to keep it modern as you go.
And isn't that the ultimate like beloved homage to just keep updating your lyrics so that it works for every time it gets played? Yeah. No, I love
that. So it's kind of fun to compare different productions. But then the downside is that you rely on the company today writing as well as Gilbert can write, which...
Yeah, that's a high bar.
Which is a high bar to get over.
Are there, like, Gilbert and Sullivan purists out there that get, like, that just freak out every time this happens?
Oh, I'm sure there are, yeah.
Oh, my God. Which is fair.
I mean... I also have a certain concern, you know, with, like, censorship and, like, changing things in the past to make them seem more palatable to us.
And if this was, like, you know... a book that was being updated, I would be outraged by that. Like, I would be on that bandwagon. Yeah. But I don't know. Don't you think that musicals are more of a living document than... I mean, they're being performed. They're being actively performed by modern people. I feel like, to me, that feels more flexible.
And I would say, in particular, since these plays were so focused on satire, that it adds a little more oomph to, like, this should stay current.
Yeah.
You know, this should continue to be worked on.
Oh, my God. I really want to find the subreddit, though, with, like, Gilbert and Sullivan texturalists who are just outraged every time someone changes it.
Yeah. You know, I delved pretty deep, but I didn't go quite that deep. I did protect my sanity to some extent. So we've explored the libretto in the book. Let's get a little bit more into the music and certain issues with it. Some of the music... is just so Victorian and is so English that it's
like... I don't
know
if I'm ready to leave Gilbert behind and difficult. Go into Sullivan.
Well, all good things must pass. here's one of the... So we were talking about dilemma songs earlier with that nice dilemma we have here. This is the dilemma song in the Mikado.
Here's how to do if I marry you. When your time has come to perish, then the maiden whom you cherish must be slaughtered too. Here's how to do. Here's how to do.
I hate that.
Oh my.
I really hate that song.
It is, like, actively irritating. That song is
aggressively annoying. And the lyrics are bad, too, but I think the music in particular is I hate it.
Was it supposed to be irritating, though?
It's supposed to be cute.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And actually, this is how Sullivan writes women.
That's a literal mess. That's a hot... That's a musical equivalent of a hot mess.
That's what Sullivan thinks of women, apparently.
Oh, my God.
I mean, these are the young maidens in Pirates of Penzance.
Right.
A lot of the music, since it's inspired by opera, does tend to have that, like, Italian feel to it. So this is the Emperor in the Mikado.
Am I object all sublime? I shall achieve in time to let the punishment fit to the crime. The punishment fit to the crime.
So that's pretty clearly Italian, like, influenced kind of sound. In Pirates, there's a song about how cops and robbers really just enjoy the simple joys of life when they're not chasing each other around, which is a very English thing to think in the first place. And then this is how that's written.
When a felon's not engaged in
his employment,
or maturing his felonious little plan, his capacity for innocent
enjoyment
is just as great as any honest man.
Honest man.
So that's about as English as a song could be.
I love it.
It's very fun. And then another thing he does that I think is really cool is the interweaving of three musical parts. So this is a bit from the Mikado where we have the three different advisors talking about why they should not be the one to be executed. They're trying to decide between the three of them who to kill.
Right.
Like you do. It's a comic musical. So he writes this, and I think the music really does a good job of sort of capturing these three perspectives on the same idea.
Mm. I am so proud if I allowed my family pride to be my guide. I volunteer to quit this sphere instead of you in a minute or two.
So it's rhythm one.
My brain, it teems with endless schemes, both good and new. Forty-tee-poo, forty-tee-poo. But if I flit the benefit that I diffuse, the town would lose. Now every man to aid his clan should plot and plan as best he can.
I heard one day a gentleman say the criminals who are cut in two can hardly feel the fatal steel, and so are slain without much pain. If this is true, it's jolly for you. Your courage grew to bid us adieu.
So then we get them all three together.
I am so proud.
So they're all saying essentially the same thing, which is, I don't want to get executed. And it all comes together in, I think, a really neat way.
Yeah. I feel like I was only interested in Gilbert and sort of was like, he's the powerhouse in this duo. But that's really cool. Okay. All right, Sullivan. All right. All right.
Sullivan's growing on you a little bit.
Growing on me.
That's good. And that pretty much brings me to the end of the Gilbert and Sullivan analysis. I want to talk a little bit about, though, how that it influenced us.
Yeah.
So Gilbert and Sullivan were hugely influential to a lot of forms of music, and especially the musical throughout the 20th century. There's a lot of references in all kinds of plays and in a lot of songs.
Even if you don't know who they are, you know who they are, I think. Right?
You've certainly heard some of these melodies. And then, like I said, some phrases have just entered the lexicon as well.
Totally.
So I want to play the song that first introduced me to Gilbert and Sullivan way back when. As a kid, I was a nerd, and I loved novelty music.
Listeners, this is a shock.
So I had the Dr. Demento 20th anniversary double CD, and it was excellent.
And as all ballers did.
It has hits like Fish Heads and Another One Rides the Bus on it. And it also had this tune from Tom Lehrer.
It's simply the names of the chemical elements set to a Gilbert and Sullivan tune. There's gold and californium and fermium and berkelium and also mendelevium, einsteinium, nobelium and argon, kryptonium, radon, zinc, nitric, and rhodium and chlorine, carbon, cobalt, copper, tungsten, tin, and sodium. These are the only ones of which the news has come to Harvard. And there may be many others, but they haven't been discovered. Thank you. You may be interested to know that there is an older, much earlier version of that song, which is due to Aristotle, and which goes like this. There's earth and air and fire and water.
I like that one.
I've definitely heard that before. Did you play it for me, or did I hear that in a science class at some point?
You might have. I heard it in a science class at one point.
Okay, I think that must have been what it was.
Also,
okay.
I think in my sixth grade talent show, a kid performed it, and that kid was not me.
I was just going to ask.
Believe it or not.
Damn it, you got to the joke before me.
Tom Lehrer is great. He was a child prodigy. He was a mathematician and a lecturer on musical theater. So he was like a co-professor of math and music theater.
Which is your dream job, I feel like.
So he does. There's a great track that I'll probably reference as I do more of these things on the musical. It's his version of what the folk song Clementine would sound like if done in different styles. Mm-hmm. So it's the old, oh my darling, oh my darling. So this is what he thinks, how Gilbert and Sullivan would have written Clementine.
And to end on a happy note, one can always count on Gilbert and Sullivan for a rousing finale full of words and music and signifying nothing.
A Shakespeare joke to lead into a Gilbert and Sullivan parody.
That I missed her, depressed her young sister named Esther, this mister to pester she try. Now a pestering sister's a festering blister, you'd best resist her, say I. The mister resisted, the sister persisted, I kissed her, all loyalty slipped. When she said I could have her, her sister's cadaver must surely have turned in its crypt. Yes, 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 yes. But I love she and she loves me, enraptured are the both of we. Yes, I love she and she loves I, and will through all eternity. See what I mean?
I mean, I love it so much.
So spot on. Yes, 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 yes. Then as we, so that was in the 50s and 60s that he was doing his stuff. If we move forward a little bit in time to the 70s, Stephen Sondheim wrote some very Sondheimian versions of some of these Gilbert and Sullivan type models.
Yeah,
it definitely has a lot of his character, but he fits it into some of these Gilbert and Sullivan type setups. He has a patter song in 1970s Company, and it goes like this.
Honey, I can't find my cufflinks.
They're on the dresser, right next to my suicide note.
It's dark.
Listen, everybody, look, I don't know what you're waiting for. A wedding? What's a wedding? It's a prehistoric ritual where everybody promises fidelity forever, which is maybe the most horrifying word I've ever heard, and which is followed by a honeymoon where suddenly he'll realize he's saddled with a nut and want to kill me, which he should. Thanks a bunch, but I'm not getting married. So go have lunch, because I'm not getting married. You've been grand, but I'm not getting married. And don't just stand there, I'm not getting married. And don't tell Paul, but I'm not getting married today.
I mean, that is my song. That is my theme song.
So he sort of takes the patter song idea and fits it to the purpose that it's most suited for, which is expressing anxiety.
Yes. I love that so much. Oh, my God.
Yeah. His tightly interwoven songs with multiple voices and his love of this recursive wordplay thing, I think, is pretty similar to how Gilbert and Sullivan worked. So we mentioned the Bare Naked Ladies. Fantastic.
Have we mentioned the bit? Yes. Yeah. Yes, we did mention the bit.
You heard the one part of it. 1 Week is definitely a patter song.
Uh-huh.
And it hit number one on the Billboard charts in the 90s. But once we get into the 80s and 90s, we start seeing the influence of rap and R&B. So the waters get a little murky. You can't like totally claim that this is all Gilbert and Sullivan, because obviously rap comes from a different tradition.
Yeah.
It does not come from Victorian English roots.
No, it does not.
to say the least. But who can say, for example, whether this song draws more from rap or from Gilbert and Sullivan?
Harry Truman, Doris Day, Red China, Johnny
Yes.
May, Pacific, Walter Winchell, Joe DiMaggio.
All right. So clearly there's an appetite in both pop music and musicals for interesting poetry delivered quickly.
Yeah.
For example.
For this to succeed, there's someone else we need.
I know.
So he knows what to do in the trench, ingenuitive and fluent in French. I mean,
so he's obviously mostly working from that like rap tradition, but he's also extremely well versed in theater, and he left us this little breadcrumb in Hamilton as well.
Now I'm the model of a modern major general.
So clearly he's also referencing Gilbert and Sullivan in Hamilton. So that brings us up to today, more or less. Mm-hmm. And back to our initial question, how did shows like Hamilton and Book of Mormon become so popular? It's a story too big to tell in just one installment, but it started with Gilbert and Sullivan merging ideas from opera with English satire and recontextualizing both into this new form that they were creating. They did not create an English version of Wagner. Instead, they forged a new path, and it was a path that led to Broadway and West End being the theater capitals of the world. And it also led to this.
Cause I'm a bitch, she's a big fat bitch, she's the biggest bitch in the whole wide world. She's a stupid bitch, and there was a bitch, she's a bitch to all the boys and girls.
Their finest work.
Which obviously led directly into Book of Mormon. You can see how the whole thing connects. So thank you for joining me.
I loved it. This was a true pleasure. I'm now going to be that insufferable person that draws Gilbert and Sullivan references everywhere I go. So thank you for that and the perfect social anxiety that I now feel about it.
I've given one gift to the world. At least it can be that. I am going to continue telling the story of the musical in other installments. I think the next one will probably be Cole Porter and George Gershwin, because they're my favorites of the 20s and 30s. I guess we'll see if any other people pop up while I'm researching. I'm Peter McGuire. This is Jess.
Thank you for having me.
Last name redacted to protect the innocent. And this has been my unlikely explanation.